It's the takeaway for August 7th. After a mass shooting, there's often a predictable turn to name mental illness as the problem.
If you're talking about mental illness, you're not talking about much more difficult topics like race and racism. There's very often misogyny involved in these narratives. And also, we're not talking about gun laws. And so it's been a very useful talking point.
We're talking the overstated and politicized connection between mental illness and mass violence. Also on the show, your reactions to the death of great American author Toni Morrison.
I understood myself and my world more clearly because of her fine mind, good heart, and beautiful writing.
I was drawn forever to Toni Morrison and her writings.
And comedian Julio Torres on why he embraces the odd.
I like being on the side of the odd rather than standing and mocking the odd. When I hear a story about someone behaving strangely, rarely do I find it funny to make fun of that person.
All right, let's get started. After two horrific mass shootings over the weekend, President Trump blamed mental illness for the violence.
We must reform our mental health laws to better identify mentally disturbed individuals who may commit acts of violence and make sure those people not only get treatment, but when necessary, involuntary confinement. Mental illness and hatred pulls the trigger, not the gun.
This was not the first time the president has made that link. So far, he's blamed at least 9 high-profile mass shootings on mental illness.
We have a lot of mental health problems in our country, as do other countries.
The difficult issue of mental health.
I think that mental health is your problem here.
On Monday, the American Psychological Association released a statement responding to the president's remarks, saying the overwhelming majority of people with mental illness are not violent and that, quote, a history of violence is the single best predictor of who will commit future violence. And access to more guns and deadlier guns means more lives lost. Additional research from the University of Texas Medical Branch shows that mental health is not a major factor in someone's propensity for gun violence. But the University of Texas found that the more access someone had to guns, the more likely they were to commit acts of violence with them. Politicians, especially those from the GOP, have continued to link mass shootings to mental illness, especially when the perpetrator is white.
There's some pretty sick kids out there, and I think we got to do a better job of mental health.
It seems like one common denominator is mental illness.
There's mental health and addiction issues.
We don't know right now exactly why this deranged individual did this.
People with mental illness are getting guns and conducting these mass shootings.
So to start this hour, we're going to get the facts versus fiction on mental illness and violence in America at a moment when those words, mental illness, are being thrust to the forefront of a grieving nation's national conversation. Joining me now is Jonathan Metzl, the director of Vanderbilt University's Center for Medicine, Health, and Society. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
And on the line is Dominic Sisti, director of the Scattergood Program for Applied Ethics in Behavioral Health Care at the University of Pennsylvania. Dominic, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Jonathan, let's start with you. Is there any correlation between violence and mental illness?
Well, let me first say that I can completely understand why people turn to a mental illness narrative after mass shooting. It's such a traumatic moment. On an emotional level, I think this narrative makes sense. But on a political and policy level, it is a complete distraction. Unfortunately, data, study after study shows that persons diagnosed with serious major mental illness are, in fact, much more likely to be the victims of violence, not the perpetrators of violence. And if you just go down the list, depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, all the major psychiatric diagnoses, these are all mental illnesses that end up taking people away from society. So they're less likely to plan an attack, commit an attack, factors like that.
Well, there's also the question, Jonathan, about the underlying issues for many of the shooters, not all, but many of the ones that we're learning about seems to be radicalization, hatred of women, of people of color. I'm wondering why so many politicians are conflating those issues with mental illness.
Well, it's an easy talking point and it's a distraction. If you're talking about mental illness, you're not talking about much more difficult topics like race and racism. There's very often misogyny involved in these narratives. And also, we're not talking about gun laws. And so it's been a very useful talking point to not get us to talk about what we should be talking about, which is how can we come together across divides, gun owners and people who are, you know, responsible gun owners, people on all sides of this divide, people who feel strongly about gun control. How can we come together and create reasonable policy in the middle? But when we're talking about these large, lofty, charged narratives, it makes it harder for us to enact reasonable, common sense solutions to the violence that we're all experiencing.
Dominic, I'd like to bring you in here because in the president's statement, he said that people with mental illness should be, quote, involuntarily confined in certain circumstances as a way to prevent mass shootings. What are the ethics of that proposal, Dominic?
The ethics really turn on the empirical evidence that such action would not prevent mass shootings really at all. And so it would be largely unethical and I think impractical to be able to identify individuals who are at risk for such violence and attempt to involuntarily confine them in a psychiatric hospital. There is no evidence that it would work. And two, it would be impossible to predict who those individuals should be that should be confined.
And I guess the other question is, where would these people be confined? I think we think about mental health institutions that back in the 50s and 60s that existed in this country. But is there even an infrastructure at this point to even carry out something like that?
There are psychiatric hospitals and there are state laws that would mandate an individual who is a risk to themselves or others to be placed involuntarily in a psychiatric ward. The capacity for forensic use is there. The capacity for civil use to get people the care they need, the treatment they need in a psychiatric hospital is largely not there. The number of beds in this country has evaporated significantly since the 1970s, and we now have a dearth of psychiatric beds in this country for people who are seriously mentally ill and who need structured inpatient care. It's not important to prevent mass shootings. Let me just say that up front. The idea of increasing our bed capacity, and that's, you know, that's sort of the metric that we use to describe how much inpatient care is available in this country for psychiatric problems, is important because there are individuals with very serious mental illnesses who are not receiving the treatment they need in the community.
And to that point, Jonathan, Congress and President Trump have talked a lot about reforming mental health laws to address current and future violence. But what have they actually done towards that end? I mean, have they done anything to promote mental health awareness or treatment?
As a psychiatrist, I'm all for more mental health treatment. I'm all for investing more in the mental health system. That's a different issue than preventing mass shootings entirely. But it is important to note that, you know, I can list many instances from President Trump overturning President Obama's executive orders about eliminating firearms to people with very severe mental illness. Not that those people would commit a shooting, they're just quite debilitated. But President Trump overturned that a couple of years ago. Everything to things that aren't really getting talked about right now, like attacking the Affordable Care Act. Well, the Affordable Care Act had a lot of language about mental illness parity. And so, in a way, the actions that have been done by the Trump administration are really undermining mental illness treatment. Now, there is one other important point to keep in mind, which is President Trump also mentioned so-called red flag laws. Those are laws that try to kind of find a kind of narrow space between these large issues. Red flag laws allow for a temporary removal of a firearm from someone who may be an imminent threat to themselves or someone else just for a period of between 7 and 21 days. And that kind of uses the mental illness language, but it doesn't use the diagnosis, right? I think that's the important point. So there is a narrowed point of hope here, and we'll have to see what happens with that particular issue.
And Dominic, I want to get your thoughts on red flag laws, because the president and other members of the GOP have been touting these red flag laws, you know, since this shooting. But it almost feels that this is putting the onus on family members to make a diagnosis about something. Dominic, I'm curious about your thoughts on the ethics of doing that.
So I think that, you know, the red flag laws are a common sense idea. I think it is a good idea to allow the people who are most intimately aware of the individual's values and motives to have a voice, to be able to say, you know, my son is acting strangely. He might be dangerous. He has access to firearms. It does get dicey. It does get difficult for family members to have that burden on them to be able to say with confidence, you know, my son is having trouble, is potentially violent. Let's get the guns away. Oftentimes, family members themselves are gun collectors. There's guns in the home. There's a multifaceted problem here in the fact that there just are guns everywhere. And so while the red flag laws might take a marginal chunk of the risk away, the nation is just flooded with guns. So it will be really difficult to keep these really awful weapons out of the hands of people who want to use them.
We spoke to Devlin Barrett, who's from the Washington Post and was covering these issues about the political side of red flag laws. And I want to play a clip about what he had to say.
So when you talk about red flag laws, it's another way for Republicans to say, we're not going to look at guns. We are going to look at mental health, and we are going to push those decisions down to the states, because the reality is in a lot of states, it would be fairly difficult to pass red flag laws, and you're basically pushing that responsibility down as opposed to up to Washington.
Jonathan, your thoughts?
There's a reason why these are state level laws. These aren't federal laws. And I think it's important to note that the data that we have so far, red flag laws really have only been in effect in 17 states and DC. Since 2013 is when they started. The best data that we have is that they're possibly effective in preventing suicide. Their effectiveness in preventing mass shooting is really anecdotal at this point. I personally only know of a few studies that show about interventions that stop mass shootings. And those aren't about red flag laws. They're actually about state level gun policies. So if you live in a state that has tight gun laws and the states around you have tight gun laws, your state will probably have fewer mass shootings. So it really gets back to red flag laws are important in conjunction with laws that do everything else.
Dominic, I'm curious about, we hear about this often, that the perpetrator, if the perpetrator of a mass shooting is white, the initial response is that this was about mental illness. If not, we often don't hear about the mental illness explanation if there's the shooter is of color. And I'm wondering, do you have any sense of what role the perpetrator's race plays in this use of the term mental illness?
We hear about mental illness when it is a single white male, usually loner of some sort, who has been victimized over their life as a kid, perhaps, and now they're lashing out. And we don't hear this about individuals who are of other races and colors. They're typically branded as terrorists. For example, we didn't think of the 9/11 hijackers as mentally ill. We saw them for what they were, evil. And so when we bring out the trope of mental illness only for Caucasian white men, what we're doing is exculpating them of their evil act, in a sense. We're saying, look, they were sick. They didn't know what they were doing. They were unable to make this moral judgment correctly. And we don't hear that with minorities.
Jonathan, I want to also mention that we talked a little bit about the perpetrator's motives being sometimes driven by misogyny, by racism. But this idea that it's about mental illness also sort of ignores the societal elements that are influencing these men, largely men, to commit these mass shootings. I mean, what are we missing there? It's not just about video games. I mean, there are other countries in the world that have violent video games, that have mental illness, and we're not seeing the type of violence every day that we are seeing in this country.
There's no evidence that watching a video game, I mean, think about how many people play video games in this country versus the number of people who commit mass shootings. It's infinitesimal. There's no evidence that playing video games causes mass shootings. I do think that there, of course, are issues about the rise again of white nationalism and white supremacy. What do mass shootings reflect about the bigger culture of white supremacy in this country? And how can we have a conversation about the ideology?
Jonathan Metzl is the director of Vanderbilt University's Center for Medicine, Health, and Society. Thanks, Jonathan, for being with us.
Thanks so much.
And Dominic Sisti is the director of the Scattergood Program for Applied Ethics and Behavioral Healthcare at the University of Pennsylvania. Dominic, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Author Toni Morrison died on Monday night. She was 88 years old. Morrison published her first novel, The Bluest Eye, in 1970. She went on to win the Pulitzer for her novel, Beloved, and became the first African-American woman to win the Nobel Prize in Literature.
Toni Morrison was perhaps the most gifted writer in American history.
That's Wesley Lowery of The Washington Post, one of the guests from our last segment. And he said Morrison's work was so important because it unapologetically centered on Black stories.
Very often, Black writers, Black journalists, Black novelists are told that they have to write quote-unquote universal stories, as if the story of a Black American won't appeal to the rest of us. And the beauty of Toni Morrison's work was that she always refused to do that.
Morrison herself addressed this many times throughout her career, including in this 1998 interview on Australian television.
You don't think you will ever change and write books that incorporate white lives into them substantially?
I have done.
In a substantial way?
You can't understand how powerfully racist that question is, can you? Because you could never ask a white author, when are you going to write about Black people?
On Tuesday, we asked you to tell us how Toni Morrison's works have influenced your life, and many of you found yourselves within the pages of her books.
My name is Alan Hobson. I'm calling from New York City. Reading Morrison's works, it was a welcome breath of fresh air because I got to see characters look like me in the pages, reflected in the stories. You know, for a preteen like myself looking for rich stories and reputation fiction back in high school, those books had a tremendous impact. I mean, I'm super grateful for it.
My name is Reverend Dr. E. Lorraine Acey. I first read The Bluest Eye shortly after it was released, and I fell in love with her writing. I was able to relate to Picola in that book, having suffered with, I guess, a sense of racial prejudice within my own family, having been the darkest child. And as I read that story, something gripped me, and I was drawn forever to Toni Morrison and her writings.
I trudge off to bed, full of guilt and self-pity. Once I have generated a silhouette of warmth, I dare not move, for there is a cold place 1/2 inch in any direction. No one speaks to me or asks how I feel.
Morrison's prose is poetic and has the tendency to stick with you long after you put down the book.
Hi, this is Susan from Salem, Oregon. She was a great writer. I am still thinking about Beloved 20 years after reading it for the first time. We are all blessed by having had her here.
This is Nancy Hines from Fort Worth, Texas. I understood myself and my world more clearly because of her fine mind, good heart, and beautiful writing.
Victoria Valentine from Burbank, California. I'm really saddened about the loss of Toni Morrison. As there are no words appropriate to describe the impact of her words upon my soul. The last paragraph of Song of Solomon had me on my knees, literally on my knees, sobbing. This line in particular, "You want my life? Milkman was not shouting now. You need it?
Here." Without wiping away the tears, taking a deep breath, or even bending his knees, he leaped. As fleet and bright as a lodestar, he wheeled toward guitar, and it did not matter which one of them would give up his ghost in the killing arms of his brother, for now he knew what Shalimar knew: if you surrendered to the air, you could ride it.
Tell us what Toni Morrison's writing has meant to you. We're still collecting your stories on Twitter at The Takeaway.
Hola, soy Julio Torres y están escuchando The Takeaway con Tansina Vega.
That's comedian Julio Torres, and he's been a writer at Saturday Night Live since 2016. And even though he mainly operates behind the scenes, he's managed to stand out with sketches that highlight his uniquely absurd point of view.
Introducing Wells for Sensitive Little Boys from Fisher-Price. Wells for sensitive boys to wish upon, confide in, and reflect by. Some boys live unexamined lives, but this one's heart is full of questions.
I forgot about it for years, but then I remembered that Avatar, the giant international blockbuster, used the papyrus font as its logo.
This summer, Julio has been spending more time in front of the camera. In June, his Spanish-language horror comedy Los Espookies premiered on HBO. And this Saturday, he's out with a stand-up special called My Favorite Shapes. The hour-long set finds Julio performing on a futuristic-looking stage, standing behind a conveyor belt that carries along a range of shapes and objects, from a simple square to a potted cactus.
I have begun to fear that this new cactus knows that seconds before it arrived into my apartment, I, with my bare hands, excavated the corpse of his predecessor, threw it out, wiped the vessel clean, and said, "Oh, look, a new home for you." And by the way, I can speak freely in front of this cactus because he doesn't speak any English.
The concept might seem offbeat, but Julio says the idea of performing shape-based comedy made perfect sense to him.
I've always been very compelled by the humor in objects and feel like I work best when operating through metaphor.
When we spoke this week, I asked Julio how he uses his very specific sensibilities to set himself apart in the crowded comedy scene of 2019.
I leave up to the listener whether or not I stand out from that field. But I don't know. I do things in the only way that I know how to. I like being on the side of the odd rather than standing and mocking the odd, if that makes sense. When I hear a story about someone behaving strangely, rarely do I find it funny to make fun of that person. And I'm usually on behalf of that, on the side of that person. So that's sort of how I operate.
You're almost talking about empathy there.
Yeah, sure, yes. And empathy, it's a good exercise. Even with people that we hate, it's a good exercise, I think, to try and map out how they got there.
Anybody in particular?
Well, I always end up like trying to untangle the tangled cords that is the mind of Donald Trump. And just sort of trying to, like, how did this man get here? Like, what was that childhood like?
Have you gotten us any answers?
No, what do I know? But I've read that he would throw rocks at kids when he was a kid, which makes a lot of sense. And, I mean, it's sort of like a bully psyche, right? It's deeply insecure. So we are all victims of his insecurity.
We're going to dig into that a little bit. And turn. There's so many layers to that.
Right. But
the first layer I want to take here is Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
Donald Trump has hosted Saturday Night Live. He did it before you started working there.
He did, yeah.
You've written a couple of sketches that give some insight into Melania Trump and President Trump. So how do you take what we just talked about and apply that to writing a sketch about Donald Trump?
I have indirectly dealt with the political climate a lot. But head on, there's a couple that I spearheaded. The first one was sort of extracted from my stand-up, a series of videos, very short videos called Melania Moments. These videos imagined Melania as sort of it was very much like a princess trapped in a castle. That point of view has since expired, or like very quickly expired, as we started learning more and more about her. We still don't know a bunch, but it's safe to say that she's not trapped. And then another one that I was involved in, it was called Through Donald's Eyes or Through Trump's Eyes. And it was a point of view sketch where you could just sort of be inside his head and see him waking up and see him like go throughout his day in this sort of like horrifying little journey and feel his, what scares him and like what ticks him off. That I also thought was a fun exercise.
You've been writing for SNL for almost 3 years now. I've watched the show for so many years, it's embarrassing. And so I'm a fan, but it's also been a show that's been roundly criticized for its lack of diversity in terms of its cast and even in terms of the writer's room. So you're one of a handful of writers of color, I imagine, in the writer's room. How do you balance that with the political climate today, with things like President Trump, with the controversy around our immigration policies and what's happening at the border? Like, do you feel compelled to have to write about those things, or are you just writing off of whatever is interesting that week?
Sometimes not that anyone, you know, hired me for any specific reason, or that it's, never has it been expected for me to write a certain things just because I am a certain kind of person.
So in other words, you're not, because one thing I hate is being like the cultural representative. Like,
no,
you're the Latino,
no.
So you have to write the Latino stories,
Never once have I been expected to write the Latino story or the queer story or anything like that. And I mean, first of all, there are more queer people of color behind the scenes that I think you'd imagine. They're all deeply talented. And I think that we all write the things that we are attracted to that makes us laugh. And I've been lucky to earnestly be able to explore what I artistically want to explore every week. But sometimes I do personally think like, oh, dear God, I should be the one that addresses X, Y, and Z, right? But I guess I'm just not skilled in that way. I'm not like a sort of homework writer kind of way. So sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And I think a big part of being a comedian or a performer or a writer or an artist in this climate is reconciling or just really facing the question, do I have a responsibility to directly address this? And I believe the answer is yes. I have yet to answer to what extent or in what form.
That's fair.
Yeah. Because you can't force it, right? You can't like, which is why remaining vocal and politically active beyond, you know, the jokes that you tell on stage is important.
In terms of that, shifting gears for a minute, you're also bilingual, which is fantastic.
Right.
Born and you grew up in El Salvador and lived there till about a decade ago.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that transition. When do you decide? Because a lot of U.S.-born Latinos in the United States, we use this Spanglish thing where we kind of go in and out of English and Spanish. And do you approach your comedy differently if it's for in Spanish versus in English? You did Los Spookies almost entirely in Spanish, but you know, there are a couple moments in your stand-up where you inflect that language as well. So how do you decide when to do that?
Most of my career has been in English. I came to the States wanting to be a writer, wanting to write for television and film. So for most of the work that I've done, I did it in English without thinking twice about it, which artistically gave me this sort of layer of removal from the performance, because I am creating in a second language. And it gives me this sort of like feeling of like watching everything from the outside that I have sort of come to really like. And then with Los Spookies, I was very excited to do it for a lot of reasons. But one of the reasons was getting to do comedy in my native language. And then just sort of like ping-ponging, be like, okay, so I'm from here, but I've been thinking and operating over here. What happens when I take what I learned in B and I bring it back to A? So it was this triangulation of culture and artistic experience that was very interesting.
Because not everything is translatable.
Not everything is translatable, no. And that is something that that Anna and I, who wrote Los Spookies, were thinking about a lot when we were writing. I think that we're both prone to like wordplay. And then we'd be typing and be like, abort. Because if this show is going to truly be bilingual, you can't have jokes that are just for some people. Anna is of Panamanian descent. I am a Salvadorian native. Fred's cultural background is informed by Venezuela. Our director is Mexican. Two of our leads are Mexican. And we shot in Chile with a lot of Chilean actors. So then it became this sort of like Spanish Tower of Babel, which motivated us to set the world of the story in an imagined country rather than having Chileans put on their best Mexican accent, which is an idea that we entertained for a little bit, mm-hmm. we decided that it was going to be in this imagined nation, which was an artistic decision that I think we're very happy with. But yeah, like even within Spanish, like sometimes I'll hear people say that I sound foreign. Me, a Salvadorian who lived there up until 10 years ago. You find people like sort of like policing each other's accents mm-hmm. and being like, well, that's not how you say that. And it's like, well, that's not how you say that in the country that you're from. But that is how you say that in the next country over. There is no true neutral Spanish, obviously.
Shifting gears for a minute, you tweeted this week about getting your green card.
Yes.
Finally.
Yeah.
In this climate, mm-hmm. in this environment, you were able to pull that off. How did that feel?
A little bittersweet. I think that anyone who is not from here but lives here, regardless of how you came here or how easy or hard it was for you, you think about immigration a lot. You think about it every time you're in customs to come to the airport. You think about it when you're filing your taxes. It's sort of this like Kafkaesque cloud hovering over you at all times. So then getting the green card was a sigh of relief, thinking, okay, things are going to get a little easier now. But at the same time, receiving it at a time of great turmoil just really makes you think of how easy you had it in comparison, even though I don't think I had it easy, but just in comparison to the people who are really hurting right now. So yeah, the green card came with a bit of a, like an imposter syndrome attached to it, I feel like, which I'm still like reckoning with.
You've been here 10 years. The political climate has shifted quite a bit.
Yeah.
Particularly when it comes to immigration. Have mm-hmm. you felt that shift around in your own life, that people are treating you the same, you differently?
I came to the States just as Barack Obama was being inaugurated. And I've been here for the whole Obama administration and now the big shift. But ever since I landed in New York City and have lived here and like grown here as a person and as a comedian, I felt nothing but welcomed and encouraged and supported. So really the political climate to me is sort of a news cycle thing. I am lucky enough to be in this, I'm not going to call it a bubble because why are we the bubble? Why aren't they the bubble? But in this corner over here, it's always felt difficult but welcoming. So really, I've seen it shift, obviously, like we all have in the news. But as for how I go about navigating life, it's felt the same. And I think it's also worth mentioning that coming to the States was never easy. It was nerve-wracking when Obama was president. And I think that that's something that we also have to come to terms a little bit and just don't go too far into this fantasy that there were no deportations when Obama was president.
He was called the deporter-in-chief.
He was called the deporter-in-chief. Of course, the shift now is that it went from what I perceive as a cult thing that the government had to do to a deliberately cruel thing that in many cases it doesn't actually have to do, which is what's happening right now.
Julio Torres' stand-up special, My Favorite Shapes, premieres this Saturday on HBO. Julio, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. And we want to give a special shout out and thanks to Lee Hill, who stepped up to help the show in the past month. He's been a fantastic ear, a great leader, and we're much obliged for his presence. He's heading back to his usual role in public engagement at WNYC, so we're happy to say we'll still see him around. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. We'll see you tomorrow.